In the days and weeks leading up to 2020, it was not unusual to see news coverage that purported to explain the ramifications of changes to the state's bail laws that were scheduled to take effect in January. These pieces were often framed through the perspective of law enforcement, and with a sensationalized bent that continued into 2020 as the changes took effect, likely contributing to a curtailing of the reforms a few months later, according to an analysis of reporting in New York by Forward.us, a bipartisan political organization pursuing changes to the immigration and criminal justice systems. To discuss the findings of the report, we're joined by Laura Bennett, co-author of the report and the manager of research for criminal justice reform at Forward.us. So prior to doing this look at reporting on the implementation of the state's bail laws, what was your perception of the coverage in New York from 2019 and early 2020? And was there a point where you can recall first feeling that the reporting was problematic?
Sure. As you know, bail reform went into effect on January 1st, 2020. And in the months leading up to that, we began to see stories trickling in, since often sensationalized headlines saying that a person was released because of bail reform. And we knew that was could not be the case because the law had not yet gone into effect. When the law did actually take effect on January 1st, 2020, we really saw those stories start to ramp up. In many press outlets across the state, there were stories that claimed that individuals were released because of bail reform, and those stories often turned out to be false. There was quite a bit of reporting that conflated judicial decision-making with the mandates of the reform.
Did this reporting, though, did it stand out to you at the time, and did you notice there was a trend emerging?
Absolutely. You know, each day there would just be a deluge of clips coming in with similar headlines decrying bail reform and sort of sensationalized case-by-case stories that often turned out being false. And we began hearing from lawmakers about these stories. And certainly everyone in the advocacy community who had worked so hard to pass these historic reforms was very aware of them and concerned about their potential to undo some of the progress that had been made to address mass incarceration in New York's jails.
Your report highlights three recurring problems with the reporting on bail at the time, the first being the spread of inaccurate and misleading information. I understand what inaccuracies are, but what sort of misleading information was out there?
So what we saw again and again was that law enforcement officials often would make claims in the press saying that a person was released because of bail reform, and that often turned out to not be the case. In terms of more misleading information, there would be some sensationalized stories saying that, you know, perhaps a person had been rearrested after being released on bail reform. And the headlines would often be, you know, very sort of fear-mongering in terms of driving people to fear folks who had been released, when often these rearrests were for very minor crimes like drug offenses or crimes of poverty, where people are maybe committing small offenses just to, you know, make sure that they have enough money to get through the day.
Now, you say small offenses and minor offenses. Are you assigning, though, a judgment of those crimes that someone else might not agree with?
Certainly that is, you know, something that reasonable minds can disagree about. But what we often saw was headlines that led people to believe that quite a lot of violent acts were being committed, when what we know from the data is that most people who were released because of bail reform went home to await trial and were not rearrested at all, and certainly were not rearrested for anything that involved violence in the vast, vast majority of cases.
The second recurring problem you identified was, quote-unquote, dehumanizing language. How did that manifest itself?
Sure. So this is something we saw permeating stories sort of across many news outlets. We saw the use of words like violent criminal. We saw the use of words like serial crook. We saw the use of words like thug. And all of those words are harmful to the people that they are referring to. First of all, bail reform applies to people who have not been convicted of a crime. They've been arrested, but not yet convicted. So referring to someone as a violent criminal is just unconscionable. And using a word like thug has obvious racialized implications. It's been used to spread fear about Black people in this country for years. And that's something that we saw showing up in headlines really across the state.
Putting aside the term thug, which has obvious racial connotations to it, but things like criminal or crook, if they just thrown up the word alleged, would that have been okay?
I think it's important in reporting to try to focus on the fact that we're talking about people here. We're always talking about people. And using the word person is quite simple and helps to avoid some of these practices that can cause undue and unnecessary fear in the public.
You're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're talking about a report that analyzes the media reporting on changes to the state's bail laws. And our guest is Laura Bennett, co-author of the research and the manager of research for criminal justice reforms at Forward.us. As a reporter, I'll hear from advocacy groups about the language that they want us to use for a topic because, they have a goal of framing a debate, like minimum staffing at hospitals should be quote-unquote safe staffing, or prostitution should be called sex work. Why don't your concerns about word choice fall into the same category of, a public relations speak in order to win an argument, in terms of how this should be viewed?
What we're asking for here are two things. One is for reporting about criminal justice issues to be thoroughly fact-checked so that people's stories about misleading or false stories about people's lives aren't spread around. And the second here is to use something really simple, which is just the word person. We are talking here about people who have been accused but not convicted of crimes. Many, many, many charges are dismissed every year in New York. And to refer to a person as a criminal or a crook instead of just a person does both that individual and the general public a great disservice.
What did you think of stories that used criminal backgrounds in some of these stories? Because a lot of the times law enforcement was more than happy to hand over some of these records. Do you think those are problematic for stories as well?
The biggest issue that this report tries to highlight is inaccuracies in reporting. Mm-hmm. What we saw again and again is that reports tended to just be false, and that happened sometimes.
I understand, Laura, but I guess what I'm saying is, in terms of dehumanizing, because you might say these crimes were 5-10 years ago, or that person's not defined by things he's done in their past. So that's why I was curious about your thoughts on, you referencing records, because it kind of seems to me like it would fit with that dehumanizing aspect that you guys were highlighting.
Well, certainly we believe that every person is much more than their arrest record and should be referred to as such.
The third issue you bring up is reporting that relies solely on law enforcement sourcing. How have you seen that play out? And in addition to just using law enforcement voices, do you also see reporters give too much deference to law enforcement when there might be competing voices in a story?
This is something that I think we saw the most of in terms of going back and looking at some of the coverage that came through in the last year. It was very, very common in many news outlets for the only source in a news article to be a law enforcement official. And many of the stories that I mentioned earlier in this interview where there were inaccuracies in the reporting, those inaccuracies started with law enforcement officials who made a claim, and then that claim was later proven wrong, leading the publication to either correct or retract their story. And a big reason why that was allowed to happen is that there were no other sources often consulted. So if a public defender, for example, or a research expert in the field, or a person directly impacted by the laws had been consulted, some of those inaccuracies could have been cleared up before they went to print. I think the most prevalent and I think one of the most harmful examples of this is that NYPD Commissioner Shea began claiming almost immediately after the laws went into effect that they were leading to an increase in crime. That those claims went sort of unchallenged in the media narrative. And when data was released in July of this year, or in July of 2020, that really dug into the impact of bail reform on crime, it proved that Commissioner Shea's claims were entirely unfounded. Bail reform was not leading to a spike in shootings, was not leading to a spike in murders. So So this is something that we feel really strongly is very easy to correct in a state like New York, where there are researchers and advocates across the state who are able to serve as sources and make sure that the claims that law enforcement are making are being properly vetted.
Yeah, at the time in 2019 and early 2020, were there resources that were really making themselves available to the media? Because obviously, a public defender might not necessarily be ready to talk to the media at the drop of a hat, but were there groups that reporters should have been calling that were trying to make themselves available to correct the record and explain how this law actually worked?
Yes, absolutely. And this is something that I think is not entirely unique to New York, but is makes this practice all the more egregious in a state like New York. New York has many, many well-established and well-respected research organizations, from the Vera Institute of Justice to the Center for Court Innovation, who have been studying these issues for decades and can speak to the relationship between incarceration and crime. There's also John Jay University, which has many academics who study these issues. And the bail reform movement had hundreds of advocacy organizations, many of which were vocally in support of these reforms and offering themselves up to correct the record. And that ran the gamut from public defense organizations like the Bronx Defenders to bigger political organizations like Citizen Action. So, many of those groups were releasing press releases in response to these news articles and were certainly offering themselves up as sources consistently to the media.
And after a quick break, we'll have more with Laura Bennett, Manager of Research for Criminal Justice Reform at Forward.us and the co-author of a report that critiques the media's coverage of the bail law changes that took effect in 2020. When we get back, we'll discuss the media's portrayal of criminal justice issues more broadly, what can be done to make reporting more comprehensive, and much more. Don't go anywhere.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
We're continuing our discussion about a report critiquing the media for its reporting on changes to the state's bail laws, and our guest is Laura Bennett, co-author of the report and the manager of Research for Criminal Justice Reform at Forward.us. For this report, how did you go about wrapping your arms around all of the coverage of bail as the law was being implemented and in the time before? Because I noticed there's more than, I think, 15 specific examples cited in the report, but I imagine you found many more examples than that.
Early on, in the days before implementation took effect, we saw this problem starting to occur, and we started keeping track of it, in part because we were often being asked by lawmakers to respond and to explain what was going on based on these stories. And so we started keeping a record of everything that came out that was false or that had a single source of information or that used harmful words like thug. And what we were left with at the end, after rollbacks passed, which are now leading to dramatic increases in the jail population, was this long list that sort of led us to look back at it and say, how can we prevent this from happening? Because these practices led directly to a decline in support for bail reform, which led directly to rollbacks, which are now contributing to a really indefensible rise in the jail population during a deadly pandemic.
Were any specific outlets or types of media worse offenders in your eyes?
No, this isn't about saying this paper or that paper is problematic.
But I'm just curious, did you notice anything? Because obviously, anecdotally, I would assume that more conservative-leaning outlets like the New York Post would probably have more sensational coverage than, say, their counterpart in New York City, the Daily News. But maybe I'm wrong.
No, we really saw this happening across the board. But, of course, it's important to note that it did not happen in every single news outlet or by every single reporter. There were folks who were out there trying to make sure that they were fact-checking these law enforcement claims and making sure that they were widening their list of sources. So we saw this as a very widespread problem that sort of drowned out the attempts of some reporters and some outlets to make sure that they were covering the issue fairly.
Yeah, is there any particular outlet or reporter that you did feel did a good job in presenting a nuanced picture?
Lots of reporters that covered the Capitol have had a relation, you know, got to know over time some of the folks who were working on bail reform because of their proximity to the Capitol and advocating. So we certainly had good conversations with some of the folks up in Albany. But again, this was really a sort of statewide issue that we saw occurring everywhere.
So that's an interesting arrangement you highlight, because I definitely remember at that time, I work in the third floor of the Capitol, and there are advocates and activists wandering around and constantly talking to us. So how do you recreate that, on a statewide level to ensure that reporters and newsrooms are approaching this, through the right lens? What sort of outreach can you do to transform the way they approach this?
I think that's a really important question, because bail reform is not the first, was not the first and won't be the last big piece of criminal justice reform legislation. Lawmakers are really committed to undoing the harms of mass incarceration, and there's a lot of work to do to protect what's left of bail reform, to hopefully push it further. And as you saw, lots of big advances this year in terms of halt solitary and some of the parole bills that are being considered. So this report is a big part of our effort to try to make people more aware of these practices. And hopefully point some reporters towards some of the many resources that exist in terms of checking up on claims that they're hearing from law enforcement officials and agencies, and also just enabling them to try to speak to folks with lots of different experience with this issue, not just the law enforcement officials who are openly oppositional to any changes to the criminal justice system.
What level of responsibility do you think politicians, Democratic state lawmakers in this case, have to proactively defend criminal justice changes they adopt, like bail reform in the case of what we're talking about now? Because I had a moderate Long Island Democrat come on my show after the bail changes were adopted, once the law was officially signed by the governor back in April of 2019, and he was, already backpedaling on the very principles that make cash bail problematic. Do you think that fed into this at all?
The absolutely indefensible rollbacks that passed in April certainly had many causes and factors leading to them. What we know is from watching this play out in real time, but also from a new and emerging body of research, is that lawmakers are strongly influenced by the media. The media coverage of sensationalized headlines, of outlier cases, of sort of exaggerated law enforcement claims influences public opinion. That's been documented by study after study. And we know that public opinion then influences public policy that's made by lawmakers. So what we saw here was sort of a vicious cycle of headlines that inflamed public fears, and that public backlash led to lawmakers, particularly during an election year, sort of quickly backtracking from these historic reforms. And something that's really important and that we haven't discussed a lot in these last few minutes is the impact of those rollbacks. There are thousands of people who are cycling through jails and across New York State that would not be there but for these rollbacks. And that is happening at truly the worst possible time, when jails are incredibly and even more dangerous than they usually are because of COVID-19.
As you look at the coverage surrounding the reforms to the solitary confinement laws in New York, what do you think of the coverage there? Because, from my perspective, it seems like the narrative advanced by proponents has really dominated, and the corrections officers who are opposed to the reforms that are going to be implemented have really not had as large a voice in this. What's your perception of it, Ben?
I haven't followed the Halt Solitary campaign as closely as many people have. But what I will say is that policies that directly deal with people being incarcerated or not being incarcerated tend to drive extremely sensationalized headlines.
Well, you mentioned that the criminal justice issues in New York are not going anywhere. And as we look ahead to the next couple months of the legislative session, it looks like parole reform is going to be one of the major topics for discussion in the Capitol. And I'm curious whether you've already been seeing coverage of this issue that you've found problematic and think that there's going to be likely more problematic reporting in the future, or whether you think that it's been more balanced and representative of the issues so far and you're optimistic moving forward.
This is certainly not an issue that is specific to bail reform or specific even to New York. Every time there are reforms on the table that disrupt the status quo that we have right now of mass incarceration, largely of Black people, this type of coverage follows. Our hope is that this report shines some light on that coverage, and we hope that from that, maybe some reporters will start to increase the number and types of sources they're using instead of relying solely on law enforcement, and also that people are able to take a critical look at news coverage and make sure that when they're reading a piece, a sensationalized piece, that maybe they're able to apply a critical lens and ask themselves, who was spoken to in this report, and does this ring true to me? So that's what we're hoping this report can bring about, so that really important policy like fair and timely parole, elder parole, and many of the other reforms that legislators are considering can get passed and stay in effect, so that we can keep people, you know, get people home and keep them there.
Well, we've been speaking with Laura Bennett. She is the manager of research for criminal justice reform at Forward.us and co-author of a report that looked at the media reporting on the state's bail laws back in 2019 and 2020. Laura, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by Destiny USA. Shopping, dining, and entertainment all in one location. For more information, go to www.destinyusa.com.